The National Broadcasting Company brings you the last in a series of general discussions by that noted woman commentator and former foreign correspondent, Dorothy Thompson. Miss Thompson.
I don't know whether you feel as I do. I'm tired. Tonight is the 15th consecutive day on which I've spoken to you on the news from Europe. Seems to me that between this Wednesday and that last Wednesday a fortnight ago, months have passed. Doesn't it seem that way to you? I spoke to you first on the day of the startling news that the negotiations between Russia and the Western powers had been broken off and the Soviets had signed with Nazi Germany a 10-year non-aggression treaty. That was the day, too, that Sir Neville Henderson went to Berchtesgaden with a letter of the Prime Minister to the German Chancellor, warning him that it was beyond any question whatsoever that if Germany attacked Poland, there would be a European war. And since then, the events have moved forward with kaleidoscopic swiftness to the point where we are tonight, when the Nazi troops stand at the gates of Warsaw and the French troops at the western wall of Germany. Since that first broadcast, 2 short weeks ago, more than a score of cities and towns have been bombed, the great capitals of Western civilization have been evacuated, millions of children have been put into gas masks, and men are conducting their affairs underground, away from the death that lurks in the air. And all this has been interspersed with historic speeches. You and I have heard the voice of Hitler, and the voice of Chamberlain, the voice of Delage, and the voice of King George. In our own rooms, hanging on the radio, we have listened to that incredibly moving demonstration of desperate joy that occurred in the streets of Warsaw when the British ambassador, Sir Howard Kennard, and the Polish foreign minister, Joseph Beck, appeared on a balcony together, and the delirious crowd realized that Britain was fulfilling her pledge to Poland. That was only last Saturday night, and tonight trenches are being dug around Warsaw. In between, we have read the British White Paper, that extraordinary exchange of diplomatic notes between the British government and the German government, which tells for history, in the actual text of the correspondence, the story of this war. Today, Germany has published a white book. It is the German interpretation of the events of the last 2 weeks. It is a comment on the British White Paper. But the comment does not interest us, except symptomatically to show us what the German viewpoint is, because we have the actual text of the correspondence. Apparently, the White Book of Germany is designed to present the case to the German people. For instance, it describes the contents of the letter to which I have just referred, but it does not tell the German people that the British government, in that letter, said without possible equivocation that her pledges to Poland would under all conditions be fulfilled. Nor does the German White Book make it clear, as the actual correspondence in the British White Paper does, that the German proposals to Poland were never submitted until Thursday night, and that Hitler's proclamation to the German army to strike was issued at 5 o'clock the next morning. The German White Book justifies its attack on Poland on the ground that the Warsaw radio had pronounced the proposals unacceptable. This is an amazing concept of negotiation. Proposals are made by one sovereign state to another. There is no possibility of negotiation. A radio announces that the proposals which were released by radio are unacceptable, and a war of incalculable dimensions is launched. In all this talk this week, however, about white papers and white books, one white paper has not been mentioned. And when this is all over and done with, however it may turn out, that will be the most important white paper. It was not written in the last fortnight. It was written 15 years ago in a Bavarian prison by an agitator who had attempted, with a few followers, to overthrow the government of Bavaria and organize a march on Berlin. For his attempt to destroy the German Republic, he got a few months in prison, was a tolerant republic, and he used the time to write a book. He called it Mein Kampf. And it is the German white paper on this war. With the cry, quote, "If the people but desire weapons, weapons will grow in their hands," unquote, he unrolled a picture of a German world of illimitable extent and illimitable possibilities in which, by force of a unified will, the Nazi Reich was to become the master of Europe and the leading power of the world. Beginning with a polemic of hatred against the Austro-Hungarian Empire of before the war, of which he had been a citizen, he declared that it had committed the unforgivable sin of allowing 45 million Czechs and South Slavs, Magyars, Hungarians, Poles, and Jews equal rights with the 8 million Germans of Austria. The Germans, he said, alone had organizing power. They alone were made to rule the inferior people east of the Rhine. But not only east of the Rhine. A people molded into a herd of one blood would move not by reason, but by instinct, he said, by a common will under a single leader, and such a people would be invincible. He envisioned a Reich of 250 million people, all ruled by Germans. He attacked the Kaiser. The Kaiser had made the fatal mistake of alienating both Great Britain and Russia. Never again would Germany fight a war on two fronts against Britain and Russia at the same time. The natural ally of Germany, he thought, would be Great Britain. Between them, they could divide up the world under German leadership. But if that did not come off, Russia, anyhow, was ripe for decay and absorption in one form or another. France, however, must be destroyed. She was a decadent democracy whose blood had been ruined by the admixture of alien races. He laid down the policy, quote, "The object of domestic policy is to forge a sword. The object of foreign policy is to protect that sword until it is ready to strike," unquote. He described a tactic of pursuing one's ends without using that sword as long as possible by a series of bloodless victories. He said, quote, "The shrewd victor will, if possible, keep imposing his demands by degrees. He can then, in dealing with a nation which has lost its character, and this means every nation which submits voluntarily, count on its never finding in any one act of oppression adequate ground for taking up arms," unquote. And with what phenomenal success this program has worked. The arms provision of the Treaty of Versailles were broken, only a protest. The Treaty of Locarno was broken. There was only a protest. Step by step, Austria was absorbed. Only a protest. Step by step, Czechoslovakia was absorbed. Only a protest. He had found an absolutely magic formula. The shrewd victor imposes his demands by degrees. Nations which have lost their character find in no single act of oppression a reason for taking up arms. Such an act, for instance, as Danzig or the Corridor. But make no mistake about it, all the time the arms were being forged. We heard Hitler in his speech before the Reichstag say that he had spent 90 billion marks on the German army. Just now we are hearing the various belligerents, and prominent among them the Nazis, protesting that they are in no way responsible for the breach of the peace. But in addition to the white papers that make it perfectly clear that the attack on Poland was taken in full recognition that it would mean a European war, historians will refer back to these words in Mr. Hitler's Mein Kampf, quote, "Perhaps the pacifist humane idea is quite a good one in cases where the man at the top has first thoroughly conquered and subdued the world to the extent of making himself the sole master of it," unquote. Today I looked up again the notes I wrote in my diary when I left Germany in the summer of 1934. I wrote, quote, "The Nazi state is a nation being put in readiness for a gigantic war. It is either this or it is totally insane, and I think it would be a mistake to attribute it to insanity. The Jews are being persecuted for the same reason that the pacifists and Democrats and Republicans are being thrown into jail. Everyone must be eliminated who has international sympathies or has a European outlook as opposed to a purely German nationalist outlook. The economic organization being set up is the typical economic organization of a nation in a state of war. Germany has gone to war already, and the rest of the world doesn't believe it," unquote. I think it is one of the most incredible stories of history that a man could sit down and write in advance for all the world to read exactly what he intended to do, and then step by step begin putting his plan into operation, and that the statesmen of the world should continue 2, 3, 4, 5 years to say to themselves he doesn't really mean it. Doesn't make sense. The democratic world has had a certain attitude toward life for so long. It's been so sure of its own standards. They've seen so much a part of the natural order of things that it's been impossible for it to envisage that its concepts of the good life, its traditional code of morals, its picture of government, was not always there and will not, of necessity, always be there. Certainly it was not always there. Rome was a great empire and a vast civilization, but it fell. And for 4 centuries, the civilized world was in a state of anarchy, interspersed by hundreds of little dictators holding petty states with bands of mercenaries. It took 400 years before the Christian Church organized Europe in the great peace of the High Middle Ages, in which the most beautiful cathedrals and the most glorious paintings and the most lovely towns came into existence. And unless the next months destroy them, are still there. And in that great Gothic age, the age of peace, before nationalism dawned, the age that was to be dissolved by the Renaissance and the rise of the military state, in that great Gothic age, the German spirit came perhaps to its finest expression. The loveliest German cities were built in that time, Lübeck, Rothenburg, Nuremberg. There is in the German spirit a curious polarity, the best and worst of everything. Goethe said, 2 souls dwell in the German heart. It is at once the most militaristic country and the most peace-loving folk. Its will to power and destruction is matched by its incomparable sense of preservation and conservation. If one can detach oneself from the events of the moment, and sanity demands that one does, it is fascinating to inquire why a people who among all the people of Europe have cared most tenderly for the earth, preserving most lovingly those great protectors of the earth and soil, the trees, the forests, how such a people should at the same time bring up its youth with a joyful vision of wholesale slaughter. It is fascinating to inquire why that people, who have been the great mediators of European culture, playing indeed a role not unlike that of the Jews that they pretend to hate, the nation which rediscovered for Europe the Italian Renaissance, which brought to Europe the first translations of the great Russian writers, Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, why that people, so curiously unpatriotic as, for instance, compared with the French, should at the same time be dominated by such a destructive nationalism. I'm going off the air tonight. This is my last broadcast. After all, we all have our work to do, our houses to tend, our children to look after. One cannot talk night after night on the immediate news of the day and keep a perspective. But as I close these broadcasts, I wonder which German spirit will eventually win through. The spirit of Goethe, who despised nationalism, or the spirit of Bismarck, who made the modern German military state, or the spirit of Hitler, which is something yet again. In one spirit lies hope for all the world. In the other is the world's tragedy today. Goodbye.
Ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to Dorothy Thompson, outstanding woman commentator on world affairs. Ms. Thompson's talk this evening marks the close in this series of general discussions on world affairs. This is the National Broadcasting Company, RCA Building, Radio City, New York. Thank you.